Black males are incarcerated at 14 times the rate of white males in Wisconsin, according to a new study. Undocumented immigrants receive harsher punishments in the courts for the same crime committed by citizens. What do we learn about our criminal justice system and our approach to crime and punishment when we explore the prosecution of marginalized populations? I'm Emily Auerbach. My guest is Michael Light, professor of sociology and Chicano Latino studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I'd like to start by asking you what drew you into this line of research. You have lots of articles out looking at the incarceration rates and how that intersects with race. You look at immigrant populations and what happens in the courts. What appealed to you about that line of research?
Well, probably the easiest way to answer that would be I got drawn into the research on immigration mainly because this was a sort of rare opportunity. It's not often that you find an area of study where there's so much interest, whether it's, you know, there's so much public conversation, there's so much public policy being generated around this issue, and there's actually not that much research. And this is particularly about undocumented immigration and crime. And so criminologists have been studying immigration and crime for over a century, so this is a very well sort of established area of research. But for obvious reasons, it's difficult to study the undocumented population. So the fact that we were able to sort of get some leverage on this question was really interesting. Like I said, it's not often that you see something with this much sort of interest with this little area of study. Not for lack of trying, but mostly it was data constraints, why we didn't know much about undocumented immigration and crime up until recently. Still lots of questions, but we do have more answers than we did, you know, say 10 years ago.
And what was the logical progression then from looking at undocumented immigrants and crime and then looking at, including here in Wisconsin, the racial disparity in sentencing and imprisonment?
Sure. So there's not much logical connection there. So actually, this is just an area that I've been interested for quite a long time. And so I've been doing sentencing research. This is going to date me now. For probably about 15 years. So my interest there are a little bit more happenstance. I actually interned at the U.S. Sentencing Commission when I was an undergraduate, and I've really never sort of dropped the subject. So I've been interested in doing punishment research. I did a lot of my dissertation was on punishment. So this is just an area, it's kind of center of the bullseye for what I do.
One of the things that I've learned from looking at some of the statistics and articles about Wisconsin and imprisonment as we're working on the Odyssey Beyond Bars program that we do in prison, trying to bring in higher education programs, is just how terrible Wisconsin is. Even if statistics improve in some ways over certain years, it seems Wisconsin remains, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I believe it remains the worst out of 50 states for disproportionate sentencing of black males.
Well,
or disproportionate incarceration.
So yeah, so I was going to qualify that a little bit, but you are correct. So so this is both a sort of good news, bad news scenario. Is that Wisconsin, you're absolutely correct, that Wisconsin tends to rank among the worst and as of 2022 and many years prior. So sometimes it flips around. But Wisconsin has, as of today, the worst black to white incarceration disparity. So our current black-white as of 2022, some of the most recent data we have, is 14 to 1. So the black incarceration rate is 14 to 1 compared to whites. So that's the obvious bad news. That's the worst in the country. Obvious bad news. The somewhat good news here is that that disparity has shrunk significantly over the past 20 to 30 years. So actually our peak black-white disparity was in 1994 when it was 21 to 1. So we've gone from 21 to 1 to 14 to 1. And so, again, so the progress over time, or at least the changes over time, are certainly trending in the right way. What I mean by that is it's obviously you could reduce that ratio by simply incarcerating far more whites. So I think growing the prison population, regardless of who's going in there, is probably not the best way to do this. And really what we've seen pretty significant reductions in black male incarceration, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country. So that's what's driving this decrease in the black-white ratio of incarceration.
So it's like it's terrible now, but it was even more terrible in the past. That's sort of your good news, bad news part of it.
Yeah.
Can we back up quite a bit? Because
sure.
I know some of the articles that you've published have looked at how bad the incarceration was in the past, this big prison boom. Can you talk about the dates for that and why it got so bad?
Sure. So what drove the prison boom? Mm-hmm. Sure. So there's actually there's quite a bit of work here, and most of it is not mine. So I will gladly just sort of, point listeners to that area. So the short answer is the incarceration boom really took off in the late 1970s. So this is really where you see. So actually, for about 50 years prior to that, if you just look from about the mid-1920s to about the mid-1970s, incarceration rates remained very stable, actually. So from year to year, you see a little bit of fluctuation. But if you look on a sort of long enough timeline, there's a lot of stability during this time. And then the late 1970s, and again, you can pin it to a date if you like, 1977, 1978, you see incarceration rates essentially take off, and they take off with a bullet. They just keep going up, 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 up. For about four decades. So we reached peak mass incarceration in the United States in about 2007, 2008. We've since seen a pretty significant national decline of about 15 to 20% since that time. And I'll talk about how that's affected different groups. But the short answer of what drove the incarceration boom is policies. And so there's a really nice book by Stephen Raphael, and I apologize to the second author. And the title of the book is Why Are So Many Americans in Prison? And they do this really nice sort of diagnostic in terms of, well, it could be increase in crime. Doesn't appear to be that. It could be driven by a whole host of things. It could be more arrests per crime. It could be more prosecutions. The answer that they come to overwhelmingly, so again, it's usually not just one story. There's usually a few. But one of the short answers is that people are just far more likely to be sentenced to prison over time, is that what we saw is that the same person committing, say, an assault perhaps in the 1950s may not have gone to prison, but then that person was virtually guaranteed to go to prison, to receive some kind of prison sanction as, time went on in the late 70s, early 80s and 90s and so forth.
Is any of it economic? Prisons are big business.
There's not much evidence to suggest that, and again, or I should say, I'm unaware of much evidence to suggest that this is an economic driver. And so I'm not sure exactly. Prisons are also a huge fiscal drain. And so you can point to examples where, public prisons where, people have lobbied to keep a prison open even though it may be, significantly downsized or something like that, because it does generate jobs and things like that. I mean, obviously, some of these places are large employers, particularly in smaller communities. However, we saw a pretty substantial turnaround during the Great Recession, where many states were facing dire fiscal consequences. And across the political spectrum, we saw many states sort of look to their prison populations as a way to perhaps say, we should try and downsize in order to try and save some of these resources. So there's sort of this double-edged sword of, yes, prisons do create create jobs prison guards and things like that. However, in the aggregate, they are huge fiscal drains for most states.
Let's talk a little bit about incarceration and racial bias. Mm-hmm. Langston Hughes writes in a short four-line poem called Justice that justice is a blind goddess, is a thing to which we black are wise. Her bandage hides two festering sores that once perhaps were eyes. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to think of justice as blind, very objective, but we know that's not the case. Can you talk a little bit about racial bias and what you see over time in terms of who's in our prisons in the past and now?
Sure. So again, we can divide this in a few different ways. So we can talk about racial bias. So again, there's been lots of different work in terms of racial disparities in arrest decisions and racial disparities in police use of force and racial disparities in prosecution. So we can talk about, police use of force is one of the least studied areas, and there's a very sort of well-known, generated tremendous amount of talk and controversy, a study by economist Roland Fryer looking at racial disparities in police use of force. I can talk a little bit about that if you like. There's also research on, I've done work on racial disparities and specifically sentencing. So what happens? So you're looking at a population of people who are convicted and, you know, do you see differences, right? And so the core question that we tend to ask there is, you know, how do similarly situated white and African-American defendants fare, right? And so what we mean by similarly situated is the two most important determinants of the sentence you get is it's definitely not your race, it's not your sex, it's not your age, it's the severity of your crime and your criminal history. So you have to be able to control for things like that. You have to have quality controls for that. But what we still find is even when you do control for things, so again, you compare two defendants who are roughly the same age, they're both men, one is white, one is black, and they committed similar crimes, they have similar criminal histories, we tend to see that African-American, particularly men, these disparities tend to be much more concentrated amongst men than women, that black men are more likely to be sentenced to prison. But there, again, we still have another sort of good news, bad news situation where we've seen these disparities go down considerably. And so, for example, I published a study in 2022 looking at the long-term disparities in black-white sentencing disparities in federal courts. So these would not include the sort of, you know, county courts in Wisconsin or any other state, but these include the 94 federal district courts.
And federal charges, would that often be drugs or trafficking? What kinds of charges
Drugs, firearms, immigration. Immigration is really what's driving the federal docket, you know, less in a place like Wisconsin, but certainly along the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, so we've increasingly criminalized. It kind of leads into some of the other, I think, work we'll talk about later. But immigration is the biggest part of the federal docket. After that, you would have things like drugs, drug trafficking. You'd have a lot of firearms charges. There you see basically crimes that cross state lines. So, you know, electronic crimes, things like that. But no, it'd be drugs, firearms, and immigration really driving the bus in federal courts. And what I find there is that racial disparities in sentencing have gone down substantially in federal courts. And so just to give you, so again, if you just look at the average sentence, I think I'll probably mess up the year, but if you look in, say, 1994, the average black male drug offender, actually just the average black drug offender, so convicted of a drug crime in federal courts, received on average about 48 months longer in prison. Now, that's not adjusting for criminal history, but that is still a staggering. You don't see disparities like that in virtually any state court. And so, again, so just the, if you just said, what is the mean sentence a black drug defendant gets in a federal court? It's about 48 months longer. By 2019, that difference was zero. So white and black drug offenders actually received virtually the exact same mean sentence. That was driven by two things. It was about a two-year reduction in the average sentence for black offenders and a two-year increase in the average sentence for white offenders. And so there was this sort of bifurcated where these sort of met in the middle in terms of you're reducing that disparity. And so there again, if you're concerned about, and I think you should be, racial disparities in the criminal justice system, we have seen sort of improvements there. Same thing with if you look at the drug imprisonment disparities. So we've seen substantial reductions in that disparity as well. And that's not relegated to the federal courts. That's, you know, if you just look across state courts, a very large reduction in the admission rates for drug offenses for black and white offenders.
You mentioned that you sort of are controlling when you look at this for the age of the defendant and the prior criminal history. What about income and the ability to purchase a, you know, expensive lawyer?
Sure. So it depends. Some studies are able to control for it a little better. So in the work that I do in the federal courts, we usually use a proxy for income, which is education. So it's imperfect, but we do have measures of, is this person a high school dropout? Did this person complete high school? Does this person have a college education? Things like that. The Sentencing Commission, it turns out measuring income is actually somewhat difficult for many of these populations. So, for example, the federal courts used to, so the U.S. Sentencing Commission used to measure things like income, and they dropped it because it became a highly subjective, and so it's a real question, right? How do you measure the income of somebody who is a drug trafficker, right? And so it becomes difficult. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes we don't have great measures of income. Usually we use, a lot of research uses different forms of proxies. So again, in some data you have things like education, other data you have things like, did you have a public defender? right? So that's usually a pretty strong proxy for someone's indigence, right? So that the fact that they couldn't afford a private attorney. So there's different ways that you can get at this without actually having someone's specific sort of income on a tax return or something like that.
I think the George Floyd murder in 2020 kind of shone a light in a very, glaring, horrible way on all kinds of inequities before you ever have a chance to get to sentencing. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that in terms of excessive use of force or who gets profiled and stopped. If you look at the sort of pre-sentencing story, mm-hmm. what do you find?
Where do you want to start? Do you want to talk with arrest? Because there's also decisions made pre-sentencing, right? So there's things mm-hmm. like, is this person going to be detained pending trial? Since you started with George Floyd, again, the work on police use of force is fairly nascent. It's also highly controversial. And so there's a lot of debate going on. The study I referenced previously, the one by Roland Fryer, he essentially reaches two main conclusions in that study. What he finds is that Black and Hispanic citizens are more likely to have force used against them. They are more likely to have police use of force used against them at the sort of lower end of the spectrum of force. And so this is ranged from anything from going hands-on. So it doesn't have to necessarily mean a strike, but it could just mean putting somebody in handcuffs. It could mean, various forms of force. And that includes hitting. But what he finds is that he doesn't find racial disparities in lethal use of force. And he specifically looks at whether or not somebody, a firearm was used against a person or a taser was deployed against this person. And so that was the more that generated a tremendous amount of controversy. And, people have debated and written articles back and forth. But our current state of knowledge is, that's one of the certainly the stronger studies that's out there. This work remains fairly nascent. And so I think there'll be more studies in the future. But does that help answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talked about your work on federal court. You've mm-hmm. also published about sort of the, Wisconsin court as well. And the generational shift, race, and the mm-hmm. declining lifetime risk of imprisonment, that, again, we've got some bad good news, sort mm-hmm. of where it's still terrible, Wisconsin's still the worst, but not as bad as it used to be. Mm-hmm. If you had to, come up with ideas about why you've got black males incarcerated at 14 times the rate of white males in Wisconsin, or somewhere around there still, why do you think that is?
Sure. So that's almost certainly a very complicated mm-hmm. answer. There's no this is the thing. Unfortunately, Wisconsin measures pretty poorly on racial disparities across a spectrum of different issues. So these range from, education to poverty to income to residential segregation. So certainly there's a that's part of the story, is that disparities in the criminal justice system reflect disparities in the larger throughout the state. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're talking about the pipeline to prison, that
Correct.
Before someone gets to prison, you have to go back and look at what kind of inequities there are early on, including in childhood.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, mm-hmm. there's that's absolutely part of the story, right? And so, I don't even think I'd feel comfortable putting a proportion, right? Is that 20% of the story? Is that 50%? Something like that. I'm not sure. But then we do see disparities in arrest patterns. It's always difficult. It's difficult to discern. Arrests are a function of both criminal behavior and police behavior, right? And so it's always hard to distinguish which one is sort of driving the bus there. Some arrests clearly have more discretion than others. And so some people try to focus on more of these sort of discretionary arrests. But it would certainly be a function of there are disparities in the criminal justice system. There's lots of disparities outside of the criminal justice system that also contribute to that disparity in incarceration, right? So the incarceration is sort of the end of a host of processes, some of them criminal justice, some of them not. But it would be a complex story, a mix of those things.
I think it might have been in one of the articles that you wrote or somewhere else that I read that Hawaii was the best state in terms of disparity. But even there, it was still double the incarceration mm-hmm. of darker skinned, you know, mm-hmm. black mm-hmm. Defendants compared to Hawaiian mm-hmm. or white defendants.
Yep. So it's rare to find states where there aren't racial disparities. And again, there are, and that was a reflection of almost certainly racial disparities in the broader population. But then we also know there are racial disparities in criminal behavior, some more in certain types of behavior. So drugs are the prototypical example of, you know, there tends to be similar levels of drug use across races, but we still see large disparities in things like drug arrest and drug sentencing. So there is a clear story of there seems to be a disparity there in, you know, whether it's police decision making, a combination of prosecutorial decision making. But that we do see racial disparities in things like violent crime and things like that, that at least partially are part of that story.
I was surprised in one of your articles to see that things are going down. Somehow that doesn't match what I've been reading or feeling about imprisonment and race. But it sounds as if now it is more likely for a black male to graduate from college than to go to prison. And that used to not be the case.
In fact, very recently, that wasn't the case. And so, yes, we've definitely seen, again, we could talk about sort of as a good news. This seems to be the theme is both good news, bad news. And that is we've seen a dramatic reduction in so the overall rates of incarceration since about 2007, 2008 have gone up about 20%. But not all groups have experienced that same. So it hasn't been sort of 20% across the board. In fact, what our study looked at, so this was a study published in Demography in 2023, I believe. What we looked at is the consequence of these pretty substantial reduction in incarceration for black men specifically. So the incarceration rate for black men peaked in 1999, or right around 2000 is when we sort of saw peak incarceration for black men. Between 1999 and 2019, we saw a 44% reduction in black male incarceration. In Wisconsin, that was about 31%. So incarceration was a little bit below below the national average, but still a substantial reduction. So black men have experienced a substantial reduction in incarceration over the past, say, 20 years or so. And so what we did in the study, one was to document how widespread is this? Is this just driven by a few states? So there's some work that says, well, really, this is concentrated in a few places. This really isn't a broad pattern. We, in fact, find it is a broad pattern. In fact, every state in the United States over the past 20 years has seen a pretty substantial reduction in black male incarceration. So again, a notable, and this spans the political spectrum. So for example, we see dramatic reductions in places like Texas. We also see dramatic reductions in places like California. So it doesn't appear to be driven by sort of Republican or Democrat. So this is a pretty broad reduction. And so what we're interested in is not just looking at how black male incarceration rates have changed over time, but also what are the consequences for lifetime risk of imprisonment. And so many people have heard this statistic in various places. We've seen politicians talk about it. We've seen it in various policy documents that one in three black men born today would be incarcerated at some point in their life. So not are incarcerated currently, but they're ever going to experience this.
And that was compared to one in 17.
Correct.
White.
So yep. substantial racial disparities. Yeah. So black men were far more likely to be incarcerated. And that still is the case. But we have seen, so when you do these sort of projections, right, I mean, by definition, you're projecting out in the future. The core assumption of that estimate is that if incarceration rates don't change, and so, for example, there's a very, that one in three estimate, it's not that that estimate was wrong when it was created, but the assumption, so again, that came out of a report in 2001, where, again, the sort of demographic projections are indeed correct, that if incarceration rates didn't change in around 2000, one in three black men born during that year would have gone to prison. But the issue is that incarceration rates did change. In fact, black male incarceration rates changed considerably over this period. So we essentially recalculated that estimate. And what we find is that it will not be one in three black men who will go to prison. So again, about 33% was estimated if incarceration rates didn't change. But because they did change, it'll actually be about 18%. So a little less than one in five black men will go to prison at some point in their lives. And so again, 18% is still a very high, but it's also a lot better than 33%, right? So, I mean, this is almost halved in just 20 years. And to your point about, what that means is that there's substantially fewer black men who are ever going to go to prison in their lives. And that means they're going to other institutions. And so we think the most obvious sort of juxtaposition that we look at is in 2009. So again, not that long ago. In 2009, black men were more likely to have gone to prison than to get a college degree. It was about 17% would have gone to prison by age 25, whereas only 12% would have gone and got a college degree. 10 years later, so again, just one decade later, you look at 2019, those numbers completely flipped. So at that point, it was about 17% of black men could have expected to graduate college by 25, and only 12% would have gone to prison by age 25. And so that's encouraging for a few reasons. One, because that's a pretty substantial change in a relatively short period. Two, because that's not based on any projections. Those are actual people. Those are people who have already lived their lives. Does that make sense? We're not making any assumptions about what might happen into the future. We're saying these changes have already occurred, that black men were more likely to go to prison during this period. And three, what that means is that the overwhelming majority of those men are never going to go to prison. So first-time prison admission is a young man's game. And so if you get to a certain age, and especially if you get a college degree, there are very few college-educated men who end up going to prison. And so what you know we sort of talk about in the paper, and the term that I often use, is that for many of these men, they've achieved what I think of as escape velocity. They've sort of missed their prime window of prison exposure, and they're never coming back. So they have essentially, they're almost certainly never going to be incarcerated. So that's very encouraging. And to the point about, and the other part that is, I think, encouraging is that 44% reduction in black male incarceration is driven by young men not going to prison. So, for example, it might not be as encouraging if all we were doing was releasing older people from prison, right? So people in their 60s or 70s who almost certainly absolutely less likely to recidivate, probably don't are much of a public safety risk. If all we were doing was releasing those folks, it may be somewhat less encouraging. What we actually find is that the largest reductions in incarceration rates are occurring for young people. And again, what's very encouraging, because what that suggests is those people are probably never going to be incarcerated. That suggests, at least gives us some reason to think that there's momentum behind that incarceration rates will continue to decrease over time, or the lifetime prevalence will continue to decrease. There's no law that says it's going to happen, but there is some population momentum to suggest that it may continue.
And so maybe there's hope that Wisconsin won't be the worst state in the nation at some point. Things can change, perhaps.
Let's hope.
We're going to talk about undocumented immigrants and crime when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Does undocumented immigration increase violent crime? Comparing crime rates between undocumented immigrants, legal immigrants, and native-born U.S. citizens in Texas. Those are just a couple of titles of articles by my guest, Michael Light. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. We are talking about crime, punishment, race, and immigration. Now we're turning to immigration. You've done a lot of work in this area, not so much in Wisconsin, because we don't have those big immigrant populations as in Texas and California. Can you talk about the whole area here of looking at undocumented immigrants and crime?
Sure. So again, I mentioned previously, so again, immigration and crime has long been a focus of criminologists, but there really wasn't much work on specifically undocumented immigration and crime. And that's a problem for a variety of reasons. One, for the obvious reason that undocumented immigration is by far the most controversial feature of contemporary immigration debates, right? And so what you had is you, up until, you know, fairly recently, you had a lot of criminologists and social scientists sort of using the work on immigration generally and inferring certain patterns that they think may hold for undocumented immigration. And that's fine, but there's sort of an obvious sort of speaking beyond the data. We really didn't know what was going on with undocumented immigration. There's reasons to think that there could be differences, right? So on the one hand, undocumented immigrants have an extremely strong incentive to avoid criminal wrongdoing because they don't even have to commit a crime to be deported. They can simply just be on the radar of, you know, you can just get pulled over for something minor, right, and lead to a removal. And so in the one sense, you might think undocumented immigration may be less crime prone. On the other hand, undocumented immigrants are also sort of by definition very marginalized, right? It's hard hard for them to get by in society, right? Whether it's obtaining driver's licenses, whether it's, you know, getting gainful employment, all these types of things that you may think could be potentially criminogenic that may lead to crime. So undocumented immigrants are in this sort of marginal place that you could think that maybe that would lead to more crime, right? So you really do have these sort of countervailing expectations. And, you know, my general approach to this is, well, we need to turn to the data then. We actually need to see what is going on. So my first sort of entry into this area was a more sort of macro level analysis. And we had state level data. And so when you hear things like, you know, there's roughly, the current estimate is roughly about 10.5 million plus or minus, right? So there's roughly about 10.5 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, sort of permanent undocumented immigrants in the United States. And again, that estimate varies. It always comes with a, you know, sort of margin of error, you know, plus or minus. The Pew Research Center puts out results. The Center for Migration Studies puts out results. The Department of Homeland Security puts out. They're all in the general ballpark. And what's particularly helpful is that they create state-level estimates. So we can see, okay, this state has this many, you know, roughly undocumented immigrants. So what we did in this analysis was we use those state level estimates, and then we mapped it onto state level crime data, and then a host of other things that, you know, sort of standard demographic controls, the poverty rate in the state, the employment rate, a lot of very sort of standard measures that you would include. And so there we look at how does the change in undocumented immigration over time correspond to changes in violent crime over time. And we focus specifically on violence for a few reasons. One, because it's the most serious form of crime. And so we think that's the one that, you know, if you're really concerned about crime in your area, you know, violence comes to the fore. Two, because we know that violent crime is far more likely to be reported, right? So this is just a very common finding in criminology that violent crimes are more likely to be reported than property crimes, particularly less serious property crimes. And so there, what we want to do is really focus on crimes that we have a little bit more confidence that we're actually tracking real changes. And what we find there is the short answer is no. Undocumented immigration does not increase violent crime. We don't find much evidence that it decreases violent crime either. The relationship appears to be fairly null at the state level. So again, we had data from 1990 to 2014. What we find is that as undocumented immigration goes up, we just don't see much of an effect. The results are, they tend to be negative, as in, you know, the line is sort of shifting downward, but they're fairly imprecise, meaning that we can't say confidently that it indeed undocumented immigration reduces violent crime. But we can say with confidence is it certainly doesn't appear to increase violent crime, at least during this period.
I was going to say there's a lot of political discourse where, you know, the undocumented immigrants are accused of being murderers and rapists, mm-hmm. and you know there's this fear mongering, I guess, that goes with it. So when you set out to kind of look at the data, did you have that in the sort of back of your mind that there's this perception that undocumented immigrants are responsible for a disproportionately high amount of violent crime?
And the key word that you just put in there was disproportionate. So what I find in particularly some of the more political or the more heated debates is I often find that people tend to be talking past one another. So we can start with something obvious, and that is, are there undocumented immigrants who have committed murders? And are there undocumented immigrants who have committed rapes? And are there undocumented immigrants? Just pick whatever category of crime. The short answer is, of course there are. Yes. And so if that is the sort of the metric of undocumented immigrants are, you know, have committed murders, well, that's obviously true. The reason why we tend to measure crime rates as a sort of a measure of public safety is because that gives you a sense of, okay, well, how violent is this city or is this neighborhood or what is my likelihood of being victimized? And that's why you adjust for the population size, right? So when you look at crime rates, again, if you just said, are there undocumented immigrants who have committed murders? Yes. But if you say, are undocumented immigrants more likely to commit murder, or does having undocumented immigrants in your city increase the murder rate? The answer is no. We don't find much evidence for that at all. And so that, at least, I think it's helpful to at least sort of, I don't know, bound the parameters of the discussion of, well, what do we mean when we say that immigration or undocumented immigration increases crime? And so absolutely, that there was at least, you know, we knew that there was this both a political movement and then also a you know, public perception about crime and immigration that's not unique to President Trump. Crime and immigration have been linked for a long time. One of the things, sort of getting back to what we did in this study, is we're also very cognizant. So we use measures of violent crime from the – these are police statistics, right, what we call official crime reports and from the FBI's uniform crime reports. So what we find is that, again, the effects tend to be generally negative, though not significant, so essentially null. What's unclear there is because we're using official crime statistics is, okay, well, does undocumented immigration lead to slightly fewer violent crimes, or does it lead to fewer crime reporting, right? Which is an obvious critique, right? And that is, well, even if you were, let's just say you're a victim of a crime, but, you know, perhaps your father is undocumented. Well, you may be reluctant to go and report to the police because you just don't want police to know, mm-hmm. you know, to be, you know, sort of asking about, or even if police, you know, are unlikely to ask about it, you're just skeptical that you just don't want to really be on the radar of, you know, police and prosecutors and things like that. So we use an alternative data source. This is the National Crime Victimization Survey. And what's particularly helpful about that is a survey that asks people about victimizations even if they didn't report to the police. And so there we can actually get at crimes that occurred that people are saying, yes, I was a victim of, you know, this type of assault or this type of robbery or whatever it might be.
And is that done anonymously then?
Or, correct.
I mean, because otherwise you're going to face the same reluctance to report, I
correct.
Would assume, and the same perhaps distrust of anyone doing a survey.
Sure. And that is that's an absolutely fantastic point. And so that is a potential problem that undocumented immigrants may just be less likely to report. So for obvious reasons, we don't ask people. And oh, by the way, as you report this, are you undocumented? One, because it's highly unlikely you could expect a truthful answer there, right? So you're not sure what you'd be getting with that data. So there's a couple things we can talk about that. One is we know undocumented immigrants are in the survey. We just don't know where they are. Does that make sense? But what we find
is... How do you know they're in the survey?
Just mathematically, they would have to be, right? If you do a survey in places where there's lots of undocumented immigrants, and so they would just have to be sort of part of the polling. But what we find is that, so for example, one of the ways you could try and get at this is sort of declinations. How many people declined to do the interview? So actually, in the NCVS, there's very high rates of, you know, around 90% for most groups. And what we find is that, so again, so undocumented immigrants are much more likely to be Latino. What we find is that Hispanics / Latinos are just as likely to decline the survey as African-Americans. I believe it's for both groups about 86% agree to take the survey. So it's about 14% decline. So if it was undocumented immigrants much more likely to decline that survey, we would expect to see a difference in sort of the racial groups. We don't really find much there. So that gives us at least more confidence. But regardless of whether or not, we can just sort of grant or put a pin in that undocumented immigrants, you know, it's unclear exactly how many of them are going to be in the survey. We still want to know, okay, well, does it increase the victimization rate regardless of undocumented immigrants are in there? And again, what we find is that, no, we find the exact same results, in fact, that tend to be negative, though not significant. When you look at the trends in undocumented immigration and the trends in violent victimizations in the NCVS. So the fact that we're seeing the same story using both the FBI's uniform crime reports and the National Crime Victimization Survey gives us confidence that this isn't a sort of statistical fluke. This is not a issue of just missing data that we, you know, haven't accounted for. It suggests we can say with, you know, some degree of confidence that it really does seem like undocumented immigration doesn't appear to increase violent crimes, whether, you know, self-reported violent victimizations or other, you know, really specific measures of crime, things like homicide, right, where there's no issue of underreporting. Right. If homicide trends are changing, it's because homicides have actually increased mm-hmm. or decreased.
And are you factoring in the language difference? In other words, are the surveys done in
yes.
Spanish as well as English?
NCVS has multiple languages, correct.
So one of your studies compared crime rates between undocumented immigrants, legal immigrants, and native-born U.S. citizens in Texas. Can you talk about that and what you found?
Sure. So this was sort of a somewhat of a logical progression of the work I was doing on undocumented immigration. So again, the first study I was talking about was what we call a sort of macro level study, where the unit of analysis is the state. So again, we're looking at states over time. We're asking, how does the trends in undocumented immigration correspond to trends in violent crime, right? So again, useful, but also it does miss some of the specific questions we have, which are undocumented immigrants more or less likely to commit crimes? In order to answer that question, you need individual level data, right? So when you're asking about crime rates, you need to look at, okay, we need to know what is the likelihood that an undocumented immigrant is going to be, you know, arrested or convicted for a felony. Same with a native-born U.S. citizen or a lawful immigrant. So we were actually able to do that, and to my knowledge, we were among the first studies to do this. An article published, I believe, in 2020 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where we used really unique data from Texas. And so the reason why this data is unique is that many states, when somebody is arrested, they're booked. So it's a very standard sort of booking process. What's unique since, say, around 2008 and onward is that increasingly we've seen this integration of federal immigration enforcement and local criminal justice enforcement. So what happens is those fingerprint information, the biometric information, is sent to the FBI, is sent to the National Crime Information Center to look for warrants, which makes a lot of sense. If somebody's arrested in Wisconsin, you mm-hmm. want to know if they're wanted for a murder in Massachusetts or something like that. But once that biometric information is shared with the FBI then shares it with the Department of Homeland Security to essentially look for immigration violations, right? So the most common one is called the IDENT database. And so the IDENT database tries to identify, okay, this person was previously deported, so we want to hold on to this person. So we're increasingly using local criminal justice officials to identify individuals for removal. This is a pretty substantial change in about the past 15 years, this sort of integration. And so the reason why this is important is because what's unique about Texas is they retain that information from the IDENT database in their own information systems. This is held by the Department of Public Safety. So what that means is you have arrest information. So you have everybody who is booked in the state of Texas over this period. So we looked at from 2012 to 2018. But then we also have the corresponding sort of responses from the DHS of whether this person is, and the data simply comes back as a very simple marker, just says legal or illegal. That was sort of the measure there. So now all of a sudden we have this data that very few people have been able to get their hands on. And that is, we can see, okay, well, how many people who are designated illegal by the Department of Homeland Security, again, what we would just call undocumented immigrants, how many of them were arrested for, say, a violent felony or a misdemeanor, or whatever it might be. So we can compare three different groups. We can compare lawful immigrants, undocumented immigrants, and the native-born U.S. citizens. And what we find basically across the board is that undocumented immigrants tend to have lower arrest rates than native-born Texans and also lawful immigrants. And that general pattern, essentially, undocumented immigrants appear to have the lowest arrest rates, and then lawful immigrants somewhere in between, and then native-born Texans would be, you know, highest. And again, we tend to see that. We've looked at a variety.
So that'd be like a flip of what people might think.
Potentially, yes. I mean, certainly for those who say that undocumented immigrants commit a disproportionate amount of crime, I would say like this certainly runs counter to that view. And again, to be clear, that doesn't mean undocumented immigrants do not commit these crimes. It simply means they are not disproportionately more likely to commit those crimes. And again, we look at this across a variety of different types of offenses. And so we look at traffic offenses, we look at property offenses, we look at assaults, we look at sexual assaults, we look at homicides. This general pattern appears to hold, again, at least in Texas, over the period that we have. And this is true whether or not we look at felonies, whether or not we look at misdemeanors, whether we look at convictions as opposed to arrest, right? So we look at various different measures of how we can get at this. And again, the general pattern appears quite robust, again, at least for the data that we have.
We're going to talk about punishment. What happens when those three groups face sentencing? Are there inequities there? We'll talk about that in a moment when we continue on University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Michael Light, and we are talking about crime, punishment, race, and immigration. So we talked about the sort of myth that undocumented immigrants commit more violent crimes, you know, because it doesn't appear to be the case in the work you've done in Texas and also, I think, in California. Let's talk about punishment. Once you do have an undocumented immigrant or even an immigrant that's here legally accused of the same violent crime as someone born in Texas who has no background in immigration, what do you find is the result of sentencing?
Sure. So, again, so there's sort of my work in immigration sort of follows two different tracks. One is looking at immigration and crime, and then the other one is looking at immigration and punishment. So one is asking, okay, what are the sort of criminological consequences of immigration? Does it lead to more crime? Does it lead to less crime? But then I also ask the follow-up question, which is, okay, well, what happens when immigrants end up in the criminal justice system? And so I've done a lot of work in this area of sort of, citizenship and punishment or immigration and punishment. And last year was one of the first studies. So I've done some of this work in federal courts, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, so the federal courts are the only place where people are actually prosecuted for immigration violations, right? Because immigration crimes, there's a lot of back and forth right now. So Texas is, in the Supreme Court going back and forth about whether or not they can make it a state crime to criminalize crossing the border. Again, these legal battles are almost certainly going to continue to play out. But for virtually most of U.S. history, essentially this was a federal matter. So only the federal courts prosecute immigration violations. And so what we saw there in the federal courts is that non-citizens tend to be punished more harshly than, similarly situated citizens. But what I was really interested in, what I kind of kept getting from, from oftentimes reviewers and other places saying, well, what about in the state courts? Federal courts are very unique because they handle immigration violations. What about in the state courts? And again, as I talked about in the last segment, we've seen this increasing integration of local criminal justice authorities with federal immigration authorities over the past, say, 15 years. Again, it's very common practice where someone's, booking information is sent to the federal government and then information is relayed back saying, yes, this person is wanted, they were previously deported, or this person, appears to be undocumented, or we want to ask this person more questions. So now all of a sudden immigration is becoming part of local criminal justice processing. And so what we wanted to know is, well, does that influence criminal justice processing? So we had very unique data from Texas and California to answer this question. Unfortunately, in California, we can only ask questions about whether or not there are differences between citizens and non-citizens. They did not have the same corresponding information about legal status. But in Texas, we could look at legal status. So we could look at not just citizens and non-citizens, but what we could look at was both, we could look at undocumented immigrants compared to lawful immigrants compared to, native-born U.S. citizens in the data. And what we find in both states, we find that non-U.S. citizens are more likely to be convicted. So again, conditional on an arrest. So these are all people who have been arrested, but conditional on an arrest. They are more likely to be convicted than similarly situated citizens, and they are more likely to be incarcerated than similarly situated citizens. However, what we find is that the effects tend to be much more pronounced in Texas. And we think the main so again, basically the way you can think about that is that it's the citizenship gap is considerably larger in Texas than it is in California. That makes a lot of sense given the amount of sort of policies and practices implemented in both states. In California, California's tried for quite a long time to try and sort of decouple their criminal justice system from immigration enforcement. They've tried really hard to ensure, and this is particularly the case for minor crimes. So to give you a very concrete example, I'm going to mess up the year, but I think it was in 2017 that California redefined what it is to redefined a misdemeanor in the state of California to include only it's punishable up to 364 days as opposed to 365. And that distinction is really important because a crime punishable up to a year is what triggers often immigration consequences. A crime that is punishable by a year or more is often what triggers immigration consequences, according to the federal government.
In terms of like you might be deported
correct.
If you have a crime that's a year or more.
That's exactly right. So what California tried to do was ensure that nobody convicted of a misdemeanor in the state of California would have sort of immigration consequences attached to that specifically because of that misdemeanor. So they're trying to sort of, particularly for minor offenses, they're really trying hard to sort of disconnect this integration of criminal justice and immigration enforcement. Texas has gone the exact opposite way. Texas has tried really hard to sort of couple their criminal justice system with federal immigration enforcement. Again, 2017 offers this really sort of perfect example of these different approaches to Texas and California. And that is in 2017, California became an official sanctuary state, right? So they passed a law saying we are a sanctuary state. And Texas during that same year became the anti-sanctuary state. They made it illegal for local jurisdictions to be pass, quote unquote, sanctuary policies. So you can see very clearly that Texas and California tried really hard to go in different directions. And we see that play out in the data. And that is, again, non-citizens tend to be more likely to be convicted and incarcerated in California, but it tends to be about a 1 to 2 percentage point difference. Whereas in Texas, we see this is more like a 6 to 7 percentage point differences. So considerably larger effects there. We think it's because they've really embraced these sort of immigration enforcement approaches to criminal justice.
I did a program recently on the Ho-Chunks and their fight for being considered citizens. And one of the things that struck me with the title about undocumented immigrants, legal immigrants, and native-born U.S. citizens in Texas is that there is this ambiguity if pretty much everybody in Texas except indigenous people would be immigrants of a sort or settlers or something. And, you know, that the whole Mexico-U.S. disputes going back make everything so complicated, don't they?
There's some really fantastic books by historians that have that talk about this. The one that first comes to mind is a book, Culling the Masses. It sort of talks about sort of the history of both race, immigration policy, not just in the United States, but in various other countries. It's a really good book. We don't spend a whole lot of time in the study focusing on that area. We do have indicators in the data about whether or not somebody is, I believe when you're in their sort of the race questions that they have there, they do have a question about Native American there. That doesn't quite get at your question about citizens and non-citizens. So again, we haven't looked specifically at this issue, but it's very interesting. I think that would be a great area for further research, because I do think it would complicate this in a way that is, I think, would be interesting. Yeah.
There's so much information here, and it certainly is eye-opening to try to think about the different ways that immigration status and race intersect with our criminal justice system. And lots of work to be done going forward, wouldn't you say?
Indeed, yes. I mean, this is going to remain pretty core to, I think, my sort of research going forward. I have using the same sort of Texas and California data, I'm continuing to do some of this work, asking questions like, does immigration enforcement lead to racial profiling? So there's a whole host of things that we're looking at. One of the important things that I think is important is to expand the scope. So obviously, Texas and California are very important. They're border states. They've taken very different approaches to immigration enforcement. But, you know, one of the things I'm trying to identify alternative data sources, particularly in places what we might call new destinations. So states, again, Texas and California have a very, you alluded to briefly, not only a complex, but a very deep, long history of immigration, right? And so they're what we would call established destinations. What would be interesting is to look at is how do these dynamics of immigration enforcement and criminal justice play out in places what you might call new destinations? So places that don't really have a history of, a long history of immigration, but are now, over the past, say, 20, 30 years have seen an influx of immigrants. So this would include places like Nebraska, Georgia, North Carolina. I'm trying to see if there's, if we can do this type of work in other places. It's a pretty heavy lift just to get places to, agree to share their data. But we're working on it.
Thank you for opening our eyes here. My guest has been Michael Light, professor of sociology and Chicano Latino studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.